Episode number 223 with the poker guys, Jonathan and Grant. Welcome to the Heads Up Poker Podcast. This is Steve Barton.
This is Mike Snyderman.
Happy New Year, Mikey.
Yeah, Happy New Year to you.
Yeah, how was your holidays and New Year's and everything? Last time we talked, I was in Vegas.
Nothing too interesting. You know, I spoiled my son. He had a great Christmas. That's what matters.
Cool.
I had New Year's Eve off for the first time in like 10 years. Thinking I was going to go out and have some fun, and I was too tired. I went to sleep. I'm turning 50 this year. I gotta give up.
Okay.
Stop worrying about things like going out and hitting the town.
How do you feel about that?
About being old and having my life be over?
About turning me a 5-0,
Steve. It's okay. Steve, I'm oblivious to things like time. I live in the present, homie.
How was your 2019? Did you have a good time? Start to finish, how's it look?
It was pretty horrible, Steve.
Really?
Well, I mean, if you look at my final results, $16 less an hour than I did the previous year.
Ooh.
I made $13,000 less, and I played like 600 hours more, or so I'd have to look. I don't know. So, terrible.
Well, you probably – did you make – more money because you worked more hours, or did you like work more and make the same?
No, I worked more and made less.
Interesting. Why do you think that is?
Because the world hates me.
Do you have a logical explanation?
That's an important question, Steve. It really is. Thank you for bringing that up. Yeah, I don't know how much has to do with me getting high, first of all.
Okay.
Originally, I said I'm only going to use that when my back hurts, and now it's just, I was doing it all the time. So, yeah, this year I started without it, not doing it. But on the other hand, like last night, it was a great game. I had to quit because, like, after 5 hours, my back was just in pain. So
yeah.
It's a legitimate issue I have. But, I'll just have to figure that out, find a different way to ease myself. And
it's tough sitting down for that long.
Yeah. How much of it is run bad? I don't know. I actually posted something on Twitter trying to get some math nerds help figuring out variance.
Mm-hmm.
Like last year, I probably played, say, 75,000 hands of live poker.
Yeah.
Over that, how big a variance can you have over that stretch in terms of, you know, number of big blinds? Could someone conceivably run from anywhere between 5 to 12 big blinds an hour in that time? I doubt it. I think that's too wide a variance. So basically, how much does this reflect my true hourly? How much was running bad? I know I had two really horrible stretches this past year, which are, you know, like one stretch losing 17,000 in a couple of weeks, another one losing 12,000. Mm-hmm. Which I don't know how much that's run bad. Again, that's a really big, that's like 15, 20 buy-in swings, which are pretty massive. I don't know how many no limit red chip players do that, or how much that's bad play. I don't know. I know like the last, I think a lot of it's run bad. I honestly think I like missed like 27 flush draws in a row and had like 10 of the other, you know, slight 10 of the other person hit it in a row. I mean, that's, you know, hyperbole, but, yeah, I got to play better, Steve. I don't know. It's pretty close to the edge here.
Well, if you can think of it like, I know when Alex looked over my database last, I had something over like 100,000 hands and I was 3 big blinds below expectation. I was 5 and I should have been 8 or something like that. And that, so I mean that, added up over every 100 hands, that adds up to a lot. So variance can be a super bitch. And he said this was completely normal. He's like, oh yeah, it's this is totally normal to be that many big blinds off in such a small sample. And I'm like, God, that seems like a lot of hands to me, but okay. You know, it, so that could be a big part of it. Do you
I might've been on the right side of variance in 2018 though, where my hourly was much higher too.
You could have been.
Yeah. I have to take that into consideration.
You could. I think it's good.
2019 was the truth.
I don't think weed can really be helping you. Maybe it was. I mean, like, remember Dusty Schmidt said he played better on weed. I don't know.
But I think
probably not.
I don't know.
Most people.
I'm not sure. Yeah.
Do you think another part of it might be that by putting in more hours, maybe you're not as mentally acute as you would be putting in less?
Yeah.
Or do you feel like you're able to just keep that stamina all the time?
No, it's gotta be a factor, right? I mean, that's the, I can't remember. I'm always put Jared Tendler and Elliot Rowe together in terms of being the two mental gurus, but I think one of them said, set the alarm for 8 hours.
And, Elliot Rowe.
Yeah. And after 8 hours, you got to go home unless it's like a absolutely killer game. But I got a different situation, Steve. I know I've referred to myself as broke before, but this was like, I broke before. It's like I always had, you know, 15, 20 buy-ins. It's just I had credit card bills and other shit, you know. So this was very close to legit broke. Like, didn't even have money to pay the rent last month. Oof. And my brother was ready to jump in and pay my rent for a month and da-da-da. I mean, pretty much reaching the end. And then, you know, I've had a little 15K upswing. So, it's unsustainable unless I start doing a lot better with results. So it's still kind of unsustainable. I'm talking about short term. Can I survive this year? Like 10 years? No, things would need to be changed. I have to cut down expenses or get a score or whatever, get married. For the time being, 2019, I guess my point was right now I have to play long hours. I've already played 117 hours this month.
Wow. We're only halfway through.
Right. So, yeah, there you go. I'm trying to do a thing, which I've been pretty successful at. My Thursday through Sunday are the 4 days where I can play full, all day long.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've done this like 50% of the time, which is where I go early, say 9 or 10 in the morning, then play for 6 to 8 hours, go to my car, sleep for an hour, come back and play for another 6 or 8 hours.
Wow.
So I'm breaking into two. Yeah, it's kind of ridiculous, Steve. This is the I'm at here. There's still moments of, I make $3,500 the other day, come home, watch a movie, get up the other day, walk on the beach. I mean, there's still so much up good side to being a poker pro, obviously. But I just, if I'm going to do it, I got to find a way to make it work. I mean, last year, with my cash game results being way down, mm-hmm. with the ridiculous hours I played, it would have been kind of enough if I, you know, never did Vegas. I probably gambled like 8,000 away in the pits. And I think I was down 14,000 in tournaments, although I sold a bunch of action for that. So I probably personally down 7 or 8.
Okay.
So even with my poor results, if you could stick another, you know, 15K in there that I didn't piss away, I can almost survive on that, but not really even. So anyways, I'm setting the bar high this year. Got to make 100,000 for the first time. And I told myself it doesn't matter how many goddamn hours I play, but that's probably not the approach. Obviously studying more I'm going to save the 13 days this month. I told myself 1 hour video every day of studying.
Oh, that's a good goal.
But I probably, you know, like at least 6 or 7 days I have got it up and watch a video, sometimes a couple of them.
Oh, good.
I finally got around to watching Andrew's, 12-part series on the main event that he played. And I don't know if you've seen that one.
Yeah, I think I'm on episode 8.
Yeah, I think I'm on 6 or something. But
okay, yeah, it's a good one. It's a good one. And, those ones he does are so good of the main every year. You know what I mean? Like, a subscription is just worth that. His are good. I love that one.
I don't know. I think I'm done with online poker. I'm going to stick to that. And yeah, I don't know, Steve. Let's just hope last year was something of an aberration and take better care of my health, play when I'm in a completely lucid state, I guess.
Yeah,
I don't know, Steve. I still don't have an exit strategy for what happens after this. So if it's over, and I'll have to eventually, somehow going back to, remember I tried to do like the web series a few years ago.
Yeah. Rampage Diaries.
Yeah. Or Poker Pro Year. I guess I'm kind of doing that in the podcast here.
Maybe like a blog or something you're saying?
I literally like once or twice a week, somebody's like, man, you got a video log. I need to see more of you. In terms of being funny at the table, I got to give myself some credit. I'm pretty much the GOAT here, you know.
You're pretty damn good. Yes.
Yeah. So I get people all the time, man, you got to have your own reality series. You got to, you know, obviously, who knows? I haven't confirmed it. I think I have permission to shoot inside the casino.
Oh, good.
For a private game, if we put it in the corner and everybody signs a slip, so it's like I can shoot some of that.
Yeah, so live at the bike kind of thing, like what Veronica does a little bit, you know, or used to do.
More just like me filming and making comments about people while they're playing and joking. It's like, you know, bird's eye.
Okay.
No, I'm not setting up, I'm not hiring a whole professional staff to come in and turn it
Okay. We got to find a guy better than $30 an hour, though, and that he's not just going to sit around and eat Oreos. Right. Well, we produce gold, fucked it up.
No, number one is I'm not taking $1 out of my pocket. I'm talking about like shooting stuff on my iPhone and putting up videos on Instagram. And
I like it.
If people start liking it, then, you know, maybe I can do like a GoFundMe. Like when I say monetize, I'm not even talking about becoming a internet celebrity here. I'm talking about, can I get $2,000 a month from a video log or whatever it is?
It's very doable, dude. I mean, last year, this show, just what we do, made $2,500, and this next one is going to be $3,000.
What are you talking about? Each month?
No, not each month. I wish each month. No, at the end of the year.
No, I was not saying $2,000 a month, but yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you really put it into it, but.
Right. Whether it's like a GoFundMe thing, hey, I want to put up, you know, create a website that has this, there's the, how do you pronounce it? The Patron or Patreon, whatever, where you know what
Patreon.
That is? Patreon. Okay. I don't even know. Somebody was talking about that.
Yeah.
You know, basically if I go, like I said, if I get a good Instagram following, say, okay, I'm going to do the same thing, but I want to get, you know, 200 people to pay $5 a month or whatever the hell it is.
Yeah.
Because if I would put any effort into this, I would have to pay myself. This isn't like shaky, you know, like I just.
Yeah, you're producing a product and people like it.
Right. So.
Yeah, that's it.
So that's pretty vague plans, but I'm like, you know, this is, I got to find some money outside of poker. I don't know how to do that. That might be a good question to ask our guests today.
Yeah. Geez, we've been hiding the lead.
Steve, I'm always the lead.
That was like the most epic hide the lead ever. That lasted 15 minutes. Jesus, that's so bad. Yes, Jonathan and Grant from the Poker Guys podcast. We're having them on today. I've listened to their show several times. I ended up playing poker with Grant at a $400 Aria. I think it was 2017. I'll have to ask him. I think it was 2 years ago. But two pros, they have their own show. They just wrote a book, How Can He Fold? And I'm excited to have him on.
Sounds like they're a successful version of me and you, Steve.
I was thinking the exact same thing. I'm like, wow, this is what we should aspire to. Maybe that should be our goal, Mikey.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't know.
But yeah, they got a successful YouTube channel, and I mean, one that like has ads come up when you click on it and stuff. So I'm sure they're, they've monetized this away from the table, like you're saying.
Yeah, that's the goal. How about you, Steve? You got any New Year's goal? You're not a New Year's. You're constantly working to self-improve. So it's not like you have to, okay.
I just wrote out an annual, goal, and, I got the marathon coming up. I ran 14 miles last weekend. I got 16 coming up, which will be the furthest I've run. I got to tell you, man, like this is running a marathon is no joke, especially at 40 years old when you've ever done it before. It's like, wow. God, at the end of that 14 miles, it took me over 3 hours. Now, I was going slow, too, but still, my knee hurt, and it was, yeah, and to think I got to go two more this week. It's like the training session is increasing, you know, and it gets up to 20, and then it backs down, and then you run the race. And so you never run the full 26. The furthest you go is 20. But yeah, it's, oh man, it's no joke. It's, it'll be an accomplishment. I don't know that I'll run another one after this. I think I'll stick to half marathons and like 10Ks and 5Ks. Like it's, I'm getting the skinny runner's body and you know, it's because right now I weigh less than 160. I'm like bouncing around 158. And before I was around 175, you know, kind of built with bigger thighs and Not anymore. You know, it's like having bigger chest muscles does nothing for running long distances. You're just carrying an extra 15 pounds every single step. And when some of these runs are 30,000 steps, like that adds up. And it, you know, it's yeah, this is no joke. This is no joke. The over under on me is 4 hours and 57 minutes. I'll take any and all action up to $200.
Wow.
So we'll see.
Hashtag motivation.
Yeah.
I'm assuming, obviously, you think you're a 60% favorite at least to do that if you're given action. So
I think so. I did my half marathon in 2:11. Now, I was done, and I could not have run another mile. And to think that I got to turn around and do that again, I'm going to have to go slower during the marathon, and that'll add up. And 75% of everyone hits a wall around like 18 or 20. So
I wouldn't take too much action, not more than a couple thousand. I mean, your body just,
yeah, anything could happen. I could get injured halfway through and not complete it.
Right.
Yeah, that, I probably won't do more than 2K. Although I don't know. It depends on how I'm feeling up to the race day.
You're so optimistic, Steve. I'm picturing you at age 60, the doctor, I'm sorry. We have a really bad news. You've got a brain tumor. You take out a pencil and pen. Tumor. How do you spell that? What is it?
Yeah, what's the cure, doc?
You're dying. What? Hold on. Just fix me up. I got
how to cure dying.
No, okay. You don't see the negative possibilities of things, Steve, which is why people like you.
Oh, well, thank you, sir. Yeah, so I got that. What else? I want to make 10K a year trading this year. Last year I made 14% and, but I only had like 12K in buy-in. So I thought I made around 5K. Then when I added up all the numbers and the dividends and stuff, I was like, oh God, it's only $1,800, but it's over 14%. I'm like, okay, that's not bad. I just got to double and triple my, my bets now. And then I think I'll be, I got to build the bankroll there. But anyways, shall we bring in our guests, Jonathan and Grant?
Sure.
All righty. We'll take a quick break and be right back with the Poker Guys. I got supersonic speed that I used to run to you. I stretched my arms for miles and miles and wrapped them all. We'll take a second here and thank our sponsors, Elliot Rowe. Yes, that soft-spoken English linguist. Meditation tapes just before you play for the type of game that you're about to play. Get in the right mindset before you play a single hand of poker. I don't play a hand of poker unless I listen to that man's voice first. And I pick the MP3 for the game I'm about to play, whether it's cash, tournaments, live, online, whatever it is. Even as a Hypnosis for Life value pack. Yes, Hypnosis for Confidence, Hypnosis for Happiness, Hypnosis for Exercise, Hypnosis for Weight Loss. Sitting down at the poker table 40 hours a week and pack on the LBs, if you know what I'm saying. You might as well get in the right mindset for having a healthy life. Very common among poker players. So I love that one. He's got them all. Hypnosis for downswings. He's got MP3s for damn near anything. I listen to one just about every single day. So check those out. Click on the link in the show notes and use the code HUPOKER. You will kick back a little to the podcast. You will score yourself a discount. Don't pay the full price. Nobody does that. And you keep this train running. Elliot Rowe, The Mindset Advantage. Also want to thank Alexander Fitzgerald for his class Master Tournament Poker in One Class. Awesome class, the best class I've ever taken on tournament poker. So if tournament poker is your game, you can get that from Alexander Fitzgerald. Click on the link in the show notes. You can also go to headsuppoker.info for either one of these and use the same code for both of them, HUPOKER. On Alex's program, you will score yourself 75% off. All right, without further ado, let's hear from the poker guys, Grant and Jonathan. Grant and Jonathan, thank you guys for coming on the show.
Thanks for having us. It's good to be here, and we're excited to be on the Heads Up Poker Podcast.
Absolutely. Heads up.
So yes, great. Sir.
But there's, you know,
we're four-handed right now.
Yeah.
Steve, what do you think? Did that sound like genuine enthusiasm?
I don't know. I feel like
I
it was.
I will not be condescended to when we have a top podcast in all poker.
Right at the beginning. Right at the beginning, there's so much trouble.
No.
So here's the thing. We might sound like we're douchebags, and we kind of are, but you're just gonna have to get past that.
Right, okay.
This whole, like, it sounds like you don't mean the thing you're saying. You can't imagine how much trouble that's been for me and Grant over the last 5 years when we talk to each other. Like, shut the hell up, man. He's like, I'm saying something sincere here. There's so much, we never believe each other. It's rough.
Where are you guys right now?
We're in Portland, Oregon, okay. In our studio, with air quotes, just yeah.
Okay.
Hanging poker. Out.
Poker Guys HQ number one.
Yeah.
Yes, sir. How did you guys meet?
Playing poker in Portland. Portland has municipal poker clubs through some laws. And we met playing poker and we're like, oh, that guy actually doesn't suck. Because at the time, a lot of people in Portland really didn't know what they were doing, as is the case in many places.
Yeah.
And kind of struck up a conversation and enjoyed speaking with each other and became friends and started a coaching business from there.
Yeah, Grant had this idea to start a coaching business. We did. It was moderately at best successful. We were just doing local poker coaching in Portland, Oregon. So as you can imagine, that's a bit of a tough road to hoe.
Yeah. And
at some point, I think Grant came up with the idea of we should do a podcast to promote the coaching business.
Okay.
So, yeah, so we did a few episodes of that. And I think it was me who said, let's not do that. Let's have a podcast that's just, you know, about poker in general and about like hands and strategy. Like that sounds way more interesting and have it not just be about Portland poker. And then that turned into a video on YouTube. And now we are the Poker Guys and we put out four pieces of media every week, rain or shine, no matter what.
So. That's impressive.
Yeah, it is. Mike and I were just talking before you guys came on the show saying that basically you guys are what Mike and I are striving to be.
Well, that is quite a compliment.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah,
thanks. Appreciate that.
I'm not striving to be shit. I'm saying if I was ambitious.
Oh, you think we're ambitious? That's interesting.
We're just more ambitious than they are.
Oh. It's got to, somebody, do you guys put an equal work on this or is it like the me and Steve relationship where I'm just, you know, I'm just sitting on top of the car and letting him do all the work? Here?
He's telling me he thinks it's this.
I think we do pretty equal work. We've always strived to have a pretty similar workload. We switch off which duties each person has, stuff like that.
Yeah, and every so often there's sort of a complaint. Like, I'm not doing enough, or you're doing too much. Actually, it's the other way around. You're not doing enough, I'm doing too much. And then, you know, we even it out really quickly.
So. Well, that's good.
Yeah. Yeah, cool.
How's the Oregon poker scene, first of all? Can you, just if you don't mind me, Steve, going back to that, I'm always curious.
It's actually kind of a hidden gem. It's kind of phenomenal as far as the rake structure is concerned. These municipal laws that I was referring to allow for these things called social gaming clubs, which are in the gray area of legality. But what really happens in practice is you get to pay a one-time door fee every day that you go to these clubs. It's usually $15, depending on the club.
Wow. And
after that, you can play whatever games they have all day without rake. So if there's a 2-5 game, you can play for 10 hours. If you paid your $15, no rake on 2-5. Sometimes if you're lucky, you get a 5-10 game. There's also sometimes bigger tournaments, not big, but like, you know, there can be a $500 tournament with 300 players with a $15 door fee. So that allows for a really player friendly rake structure. That said, there is a bit of a cap on how big tournaments can be and stuff because the clubs aren't enormous like casinos or anything like that.
For cash games, though, that's, I mean, I probably in my average 50-hour week, I'm paying $750 in rake or something.
Yeah, it's
that's a $700, $650 deduction there.
Yeah, I mean, when I was a Limit Hold'em pro back in the day, I was paying at least $20 an hour in rake for sure. And yeah, to just not have to do that is incredible.
Yeah, yeah. 15 was conservative estimate. I guess these places, they must serve some good food and drink that have people spending money other ways, because it's hard to sustain that.
How can they make a profit? Yeah.
They do definitely try to make a lot of money from food and drink, but I think also their overhead is pretty low. The way it's structured, the dealers are all volunteers. Legally, they have to be. So the dealers live entirely off of tips, which means that everybody in Portland knows to tip a bit more.
Okay, that would make sense.
Yeah, but that also means that the clubs themselves don't have to pay for as many employees. They just need like one or two floors and people to take registration. And that they don't have the same other things going on that casinos have where they need as much oversight in general.
So you guys been pretty much grinding in Oregon the last few years? Did you ever like move to Vegas or follow the circuit or anything else? Or are you just content with the poker scene there pretty much?
Well, I actually moved to Oregon in 2010. So I'd been living in Brooklyn, New York, and was playing online there for the most part. And actually doing a trip up to Foxwoods, I would say every 2 weeks or something like that, sometimes to Atlantic City, but mostly just online. I moved out here and was playing online as well. And then everything shut down completely. We'd already gotten the first Black Friday, but then in, I think it was late 2010.
2011.
Was it 2011? Yeah. Remember, I just bought a computer. It's just to play online poker, and then
congratulations! I'm trying to get one of those.
Yeah, and then they just heard these things. Away went everything, full tilt, and everything else just went away.
How do you know?
That sucked. Do you have a lot of money on there? Or?
I got all my money out eventually, but on full tilt, I had like $4,000 or something like that. It wasn't too bad, and yeah. It took years, but eventually I got it.
Had $3,400 personally. Did you guys have a bunch on there?
I had $5,000, and I withdrew $4,500. Just before it happened by blind ass luck. Mm. And I lost 500. So I was happy with that.
You didn't eventually get it? I feel like everybody got it.
No, I didn't get shit.
Wow.
I didn't pursue it either. I didn't even, like, when people were saying you could get it back. And then I looked and there was a bunch of paperwork and I'm like, $500. I don't fucking care.
Huh.
That's why I never got it again.
I guess to each his own.
Well, if you want to tell me how to get your $500, I'll go scrounge around for it.
You'll go through the work to do it.
I was so sure Full Tilt was going to pay out right away. Like PokerStars paid out so quickly, and I was just walking around telling everyone, "Oh yeah, it's going to be fine. Don't worry about it." You know, and boy, I felt pretty dumb about that. Yeah.
But back to the question at hand.
Yes.
Yeah, you were saying something about how you moved to Portland.
Oh yeah, right. So so then I moved out here and was playing online, and then that completely went away, and. So then I discovered, actually, I wasn't playing in Portland poker clubs, but there was a casino I would go to play in Washington where I'd go 3 times a week. And that was sort of how I made a living for many years out here. And then our YouTube channel and our podcast started to take off a bit. And I leveled down on poker and to focus on that a bit more. And that is really, that is now really what we do. And I play like once a week now.
Yeah. Ultimately, the same story for me is that you're asking about the last couple of years. Well, actually, for the last couple of years, both of our main sources of income have been the poker guys. We've been fortunate with sponsorship and stuff like that. Before that, we were both poker professionals, and we did get the benefits of this good Oregon poker scene, but also we both travel to the World Series of Poker every year and make other poker trips and pilgrimages and such. Yeah. So at this point, I would say we're both like semi-pros who have it as a side job, and I kind of like it better that way.
Oh, yeah. I like it way better.
Here you go, Mikey. This is exactly what Mike wants.
Excited. Without getting specific in how much you earn, I think I looked at YouTube. I just followed you on YouTube, and I think I saw 29,000 followers. Is that
something like that? Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, how many? I'm always curious when you look through these YouTube people, 300,000, 400. Like, how many followers would you need, you think, to be making like a living income? Do you know, like, if I see someone making X followers, how do I know, wow, this person is...
Yeah, do you get paid every time an ad runs on those things? Like, how does that work?
Well, there is Google ad revenue that can come in, but you need a lot more than we have to make a real living on it for just based on Google ad revenue.
Yeah.
We have niche sponsorship. So like, because we are catering to a very particular audience, our sponsors value us a little bit more than some other channels of similar size.
We've also done a good job over the years of converting our audience into customers for our sponsors. And so as a result, our sponsors have shown, our most recent sponsor especially, shown really tremendous loyalty back towards us. And so it makes that whole thing is really, it works really well. It's a nice sort of symbiotic relationship that we have.
I read probably like the first half of your book. Great job.
Thank you. Yeah.
I'm just curious. I don't know. Was this something you always planned on doing? And quickly, I don't know if I could, how to describe it, Steve. It's hand analysis, but it's also conversational. The two of you going back and forth, I guess.
It's basically
kind of like how buddies talk about poker. I don't know if that
Yeah. It's basically like, if you've listened to the Poker Guys podcast, it's basically a podcast of theirs in a book, repeated, rinse and repeat. You know, they'll take one hand and break it down. They call it the breakdown and, you know, go back and forth. And that's what it is. How many hands did you guys do? Like 40 or something? Or
that's about right. We did 37.
37. Okay. Yeah. And so they start at the beginning and it's kind of simple. It's like, okay, yeah, I would fold there as well, you know? And then as the book progresses, it gets more and more complex. And I got to say, you guys did the best, explanation of, combos that I've ever
in the last half of the book is actually written in Latin, so that's why
yeah
it gets complex. Yeah.
Steve, let him answer the question.
Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I think you actually did a pretty good job describing what we were going for with the book. And by the way, it is called How Can He Fold, for those who are curious about it, and
you can get
it on thepokerguys.net. Yeah, we were effectively trying to distill our podcast into something kind of teachable and something that people could enjoy while learning. We were trying to hit that middle where you can kind of learn at the same time as enjoying yourself, the learning coming kind of by accident. At the end of every chapter, as you guys know, we have key takeaways. So if you got a little bit lost in the muck of what we were talking about in the hand, we distill that down at the end for you guys. And we enjoyed writing it. As to how we originally decided to write the book, this is not something we had always planned. There's actually another poker author named Amanda Botfield who wrote a book called A Girl's Guide to Poker. And she asked us to write a chapter to do an example of hand analysis. And we're like, hey, that was kind of fun and kind of easy and we enjoyed it. So why don't we make a book just this and see how it goes? And that's how we started doing it.
That's cool. Yeah, I like it. And your explanation on combos was really good. And you even have pictures of the cards there, you know, if it's a visual learner too, you know, is good. You know, like your example with Ace King, there's 16 combos of Ace King, and then you have pictures of all the Ace Kings.
Pictures are for people like you, Steve.
Exactly.
Yes. If they open a book and there's not a picture in there, you get angry, you get confused.
Yeah. You know, and then you'll say, okay, now we have one ace on the board. How many combos of Ace King do you have now? Well, there's 12 because we'll just say it's the Ace of Hearts. That's now removed. And then you got pictures of the next Ace Kings. And then, you know, okay, now two are accounted for. One's in your hand, one's on the board. How many combos of Ace King could your villain have now? And then you go, okay, and you show them, you know, and it's two times two aces times four kings. And then the pocket pairs ones, if none are on the board, let's say it's aces, he could have six combinations of aces. You list them visually. If one's on the board, they could have three. If two are on the board, he could have one. If three are accounted for, he can't have pocket aces, so he'd have zero. So it's 6-3-1-0.
Steve's very excited here. You didn't know there was
something. I was, yeah.
Know there was something called counting combos of hands?
Yes. Not the way you described it. It was really good.
Well, we really appreciate that. Grant actually wrote that section. Pretty much every other part of the book we wrote together, but he wrote that one on his own. So he gets full credit for that. The one of the things though, that we really love about the book is all the illustrations of the hands throughout it. And we hired someone to design the interior of it to try and make it a little more readable and a little more easy for people who are either newer to the game or just because there's so much going on, you could quickly refer to you know, what's the river and how much is in the pot and how much does everyone have really quickly, instead of trying to remember or having to like go back through a bunch of text or something like that.
Yeah. For those who want to get a visually good looking poker book, this is the book for you. I think our interior designer, which is what you call somebody who designs the interior of a book. She did a really good job of making it kind of a fun read through the visuals. And I think it looks a lot better than most poker books in the way it represents hands and stuff. And we just kind of lucked out by finding the right person there.
That's good.
Yeah, it was a it was kind of a neat trip down memory lane for me because of the, you said there's 37 hands?
Yep.
Okay. I had seen on TV I think 5 or 6 of them. And so it was neat to read through them and then see what your, you know, what two pros are dissecting this, you know, and breaking it down. And it was neat. I remember seeing the one especially with Sammy Farhaw and Oliver Hudson, and basically they get all in. Farhaw has the nuts and Hudson has the second nuts, and he goes bust the first hand of the World Series of Poker with ace 10 versus 10s. And then your first line was after that, you're all, this is why the main event is the greatest tournament in the world.
Yeah, that one was a little rough. And to that point, Oliver Hudson, certainly not a pro, brother of Kate Hudson, an actor, but there are many pros in the book who make mistakes, in our opinion, and we don't pull any punches. That's another thing that we are kind of proud of in the book, is we're not catering to anybody. Certainly, we give the benefit of the doubt to people who we know have a deep and intelligent thought process, but we're never pulling punches, and we always are critical of plays that we think are incorrect, and in contrast, we're also celebrating plays that we think are really good.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things too that I love about the book, and I, as someone who wrote it, it's not surprising, I love a lot of things about the book, I guess, but is that like with the Oliver Hudson hand, a lot of times someone like Oliver Hudson might leave that hand, you know, go home after literally the first hand of the main event, he's busto, incredibly. He may never think about that hand again and just think like, oh, that was just unlucky. Yeah. Instead of like where I myself and Grant, and I think numerous people, like pros anyway, could never go bust in that hand. Like, no. It'd be impossible to go bust in that hand.
No, you should at least have half your stack after that.
Yeah. And so part of what I think is exciting about the book is we encourage people to think about hands that they played that either they might not examine because they just think it was unlucky, but also even when they win a hand. And that's something that I think comes up a fair amount in the book, where someone wins a hand, but we still actually don't love all the decisions they made.
Yeah. Actually, yeah. The first hand in the book is a great example where a guy loses a hand and based on the hands, he was destined to go bust no matter what.
Yeah.
But he played it in such a way that he lost value, and he may go away never re-examining that hand, saying, I was always busting on that hand, so it doesn't matter. Because he had aces full of jacks on a 3-jack board, and his opponent had quads, and his opponent was Benny Spindler, who is a known crazy person. But he check raised the turn all in, which is losing all of the value from all of Benny's bluffs. And if he never reexamines the hand because it felt like a cooler, he's missing out on a lot of teaching value there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Another one that was neat for me was the Greg Raymer one with David Williams. Yeah. I got to have Greg on the show. A few years ago, I'm blanking on the episode number now, but I asked him about that hand, and then to see it written in the book, I was like, that's pretty cool. Yeah. I like it.
I know a couple times you guys mentioned, and I'm sure any decent poker player the same thing, when you're talking about a hand that happened like 15 years ago, an iconic hand, you're like, oh, I wish I was playing back there.
Yeah.
Because there does seem to be a lot of ABC mistakes. I mean, I don't even know. The whole, obviously ranging people is the whole thing. And it seems like half the time in these hands, they're not even doing that. They're folding the top of their range or just always putting the, you know, vice versa.
Yeah. I mean, watching like EPT episodes from 2009, 2010 is just extraordinary for me, because when they were coming out, when PokerStars was putting them out back in the day, I thought I was watching the best players in the world and was trying to learn from them. And watching them now, they're, you know, 7 betting all in with queen 6 off for no reason at all. They're just all doing that constantly. And it's just bizarre. And it's bad.
It is
really bad.
And it also points to another challenge in doing both the chapters in the book, but also doing breakdowns of these hands. When we do a breakdown from a different era versus a breakdown from now, it's a fun challenge to try to bridge the gap of like, okay, we're looking at this through a modern lens, but we have to understand that these players had a completely different thought process. And so we have to understand what that means as far as what their opponents are thinking and right. how that works in that era. And if it maybe is more profitable in that era because of the reactions you generally get from your opponents.
And actually the Raymer hand's a perfect example of that, where in that chapter, we actually have a back and forth because you were not really into poker yet, I don't think, at that point. And I was very yeah. much aware of it and paying attention and things like that. But Raymer's got eights on I think it's a 4-high board or a 5-high board, something like that. And he raises the flop, and we're talking about it in the book. And one of the things we converse about is basically how Raymer knows he's always good because David Williams doesn't re-raise all in. That means David Williams never has an overpair to his eights. And yeah. like now that wouldn't be the case anymore for sure.
Right.
But then that was just pretty standard.
The better pros will balance sometimes and just flat with kings there when you re-raise.
Absolutely.
Well, yeah, these days. Yeah. Those days, maybe, as Jonathan's saying, maybe nobody was doing that.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Yeah, maybe everybody was just shipping kings on that board as a 3-bet back in 2004. Who knows?
Flopzilla hadn't been invented yet. ICMizer.
I don't think so.
It wasn't even a little sperm cell.
I mean, all we had was Harrington on Hold'em. You know, there was nothing
Harrington
else.
Harrington on Hold'em. Did we even have Equilab or Slice? I don't know if no. those were around. I don't think they were even around yet.
I don't think so.
That's amazing.
What was the Harrington on Hold'em thing? If anybody goes all in and you have 10 times that stack, you have to call yeah. no matter what your position.
That's correct. And he gives an example of calling with like Jack 6 off just because he had 10 times the guy's stack and busted the guy. So it meant it was right.
Yeah.
Amazing.
I probably poisoned my brain by writing down all the ranges that he assigned and memorizing them. You know, they're probably still back there just screwing with me.
I mean, you know, back then, that's all you needed, though. That was enough.
Yeah, it really was. People probably, in general, didn't have positionally different ranges, right? They'd have a similar range under the gun than they would have on the button.
I don't think
at least, like,
true.
The general, like, more of the general poker playing public
okay.
than now.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, it was either they were just playing queen jack offsuit no matter what,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's probably yeah. true.
Along that line, if we all want to look in our crystal ball, I mean, right now there's so much shit out there. Regarding poker. I'm not referring to your stuff as shit. I'm saying there's training sites, so much where people can learn. Is poker, at this point, there's enough people in the poker room who know it's out there and don't give a shit. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, have we seen poker got as tough as it's going to get? Because it's not like there's going to be a new surge of studying, is there? I mean, if the people now who want to get better would have already done so. This is what I'm trying to tell myself.
Well, I mean, I think at certain stake levels, that's true. So at like the 2-5 level, I think that's probably correct. Like, we're pretty close to the top end of the skill level, more or less anyway. Like, there's a little bit of osmosis that happens. So over time, everyone gets a little bit better as the good players can't help but talk
sure,
strategy
sure,
at the table.
Yeah.
But in general, I think that's true. The competing force, though, is all the younger players who are coming up through college and are playing online maybe, or in the US, not playing online, but are interested in playing, you know, just each other. And they get access to all the most, you know, recent cutting edge poker philosophy and strategy, and they're trying to apply it right away. So there's always an influx of the young people who are going to be better. But I think mostly they're going to be playing the bigger stakes, like right. pretty quickly anyway.
I think, you know, I just was thought of this. Maybe this gap of internet poker being illegal or being rare is bringing less young guys into the game. This is good news. There hasn't been as many players sitting around in college skipping their chemistry class and grinding through their equity calculators because
I think that's absolutely correct. And I think you can kind of see that through the maturation of poker over the years. I don't know if you guys remember watching the World Series of Poker in 2010, 2011. It was like, wow, the final table is all 23-year-olds, and they're all like, so young people are clearly better at poker than older people. That wasn't really the case. Those were just the people who were getting the most hands at the time. And as you can see now, it's not as common to see a final table full of young, early 20s people. It's like mostly a well-rounded age group of like 24 to 40, you know, and, yeah. and that feels like things have kind of evened out in that way. And perhaps if online poker comes back in a big way in the US, that can reverse and there'll be a new influx of young talent. But, you know, I think there would also be a new influx of really bad players and yeah, it would be
right.
really good
yeah,
for the game.
Overall, I think we got to be rooting for, obviously, legal online poker. But
yeah, I mean, yeah. it sounds nice.
It's going to happen at some point. Yeah. I'm sure of it.
Yeah, we've been saying that since 2011. Like, yeah. I'll be back anytime.
Just a couple of questions on like the business end of it. Like, I don't know, how long have you had that's a lot of followers for me. That sounds like a great achievement. Is this was it been kind of a slow build, or is there something like the podcast came out? Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I guess the order of the business ascent here. I know you first said you just did podcast for coaching, then a little bit more on that, how you changed it into a business.
Yeah, sure. So the podcast was first. That was about 5 years ago. Maybe even a little more now, 5.5, 6. And it was we did not have a large amount of listeners for a long time, for sure.
Like, we were hovering around 220, 250 for about a year at least.
Yeah, maybe even longer. And like in the early days, we would search the internet for hands to talk about. And we haven't done that for years and years, because now our followers and listeners always suggest hands to us and we pick the best ones, which is way better for us and saves time and keeps them engaged, which is great.
And you're talking about hands they want to hear about.
Yeah, it's really cool. So that was going along kind of slowly. And I actually started making videos of our podcast, meaning like I do like a short, like our podcasts are 45 minute for those out there who don't know, they're about 45 minutes long, and we do analysis of one hand, just one hand. So we go super deep into all the decisions. It's really fun. And so I started making a much shorter video that was a companion to the podcast. So I was doing like a 10-minute video that would actually show the hand and just get our sort of a summary thoughts.
Yeah, we did a secondary analysis, and then Jonathan would put together in like the simplest possible way with the simplest possible free program to just like see what was out there, you know?
That's right. I was using
How long did it take you to edit and make that video?
In the early days, it was probably about an hour to an hour and a half, would say. But it was like really low end. You know, it was unimpressive in lots of ways. You know, we didn't have lights. We wouldn't even have ourselves. We didn't really have cameras, I don't think, at that point. We didn't have anything.
At the very beginning of the video is when you just showed images of the hand.
Yeah.
The video started to get a little more traction, and we decided to put a little more work into them. So we learned a little bit of video editing skill, took it a bit more seriously, you know, set it up so that we actually had good, like reasonable lighting and put ourselves on camera.
Got professional level software. So we sort of committed to that before our audience really picked up. We were starting to do okay. I remember we got up to like 3,000 followers on YouTube. And then 2016 happened. It was just a really big year for us.
Basically, you were determined to make a better product more than Okay.
Yeah, we just sort of decided to like commit to doing a better job and hope people followed along, hope people got interested. And it worked. So YouTube started suggesting our videos to everyone. And there was a little while there in 2016 when we'd release a video and it would have 10,000 views in the first day and 20,000 views in the first week and 100,000 views. You know, there was like a 6 or 7 week period when we just hit six figures views on all videos, and it was just awesome. And we were getting calls from Poker Central about working with them, and all these things were happening. It was very exciting.
Nice.
And then it all sort of it slowed down a bit, but that was our big jump. So it wasn't really a slow rise. It was, we're just putting our heads down, working. And then this sort of explosion where we picked up half, I would say like we were up to 15,000 that one year.
And that's when we started, you know, talking about like turning this into a business and talking about getting ad revenue and stuff. And that's when we took it more seriously and really started thinking, okay, maybe this can be our real gig.
Yeah.
Okay. Sounds cool. Now I only watched one of your videos, which was, totally strategy, but do you also like, you know, Johnny Vibes or some of the other, do you guys do like, you know, you guys hanging out at the casino, or is there any of that kind of social aspect, or is this all strategy pretty much?
I would say if you're going to our channel, you're going mostly for strategy and humor and fun.
Right.
You guys are quite funny.
We also have a 5-10 cash game called Poker Time, which is like Live at the Bike, where we are the commentators. We have a RFID table set up in Portland, and we film, and then we do the commentary, put out an hour every Tuesday. We have done vlogging before, but it is certainly not our bread and butter. In the 2018 World Series of Poker, we had some professional videographers that we hired, and we did a vlog. You can find that on our channel. It's called the 2018 World Series of Poker vlog. We had like 7 or 8 episodes, which we thought were pretty cool, but also a big distraction for us when we were at the series. So we decided not to do it again. And yeah, vlogging's never been our thing. It's more strategy and then Poker Time, the cash game.
Cool. I've been trying to tell Steve, I haven't mentioned this in a while, that we should do, rather than the podcast, maybe sometimes do like a live YouTube stream where, you know, people can see our faces. I noticed the one video you have, I don't know if that's a joke. People feel like they're getting to actually know you when they see your face talking about a hand. I don't know if that's
Yeah, I mean, that was definitely part of...
The problem is Steve has a very punchable face.
Yeah, but so does Jonathan, so it's fine.
So, I mean, like, you know, I'm fucking gold in front of the camera, but I those things, I don't know if they balance out or, you know what I mean?
I think you have the right level God's of hubris to be on camera, at the very least. Yeah, no, I think that's a smart idea, generally. Like, that's part of why we started putting ourselves in the video, so people would know our faces, and that's good for the brand in general.
Yeah, and then they see you out when you're playing. And
yep.
Oh yeah, we get recognized. I mean, I can't, any casino I go to, pretty much in the world, I get recognized. Someone comes up to me and says, "The poker guys," or something.
Although they often will call us by the wrong name. Yes. They don't know which one is which.
But whatever.
Yeah.
Same color hair, it's fine. We look kind of similar.
Two tall white guys. Which one's which?
Yeah.
Are you taking notes, Steve? I wanna.
This is gold, Mikey, gold. You guys have a sports podcast that came out? Is that right?
We've had multiple iterations of sports podcasts because...
By the long sigh, I'm guessing this is just a bitter, bitter topic.
So it's a little bitter because Jonathan and I are friends outside of poker. We hang out and like one of the main things we'll do is watch sports, specifically basketball and football.
Okay.
We feel like we have fun, good discussions about that. So like, let's see if people like that because they like us talking about poker. We have this rapport. So we've multiple iterations tried making a sports podcast.
I mean, you have to talk about the most interesting iteration. There's one great iteration.
Yeah, the first iteration was called Drunk Sports, which was Jonathan, who doesn't
drink.
That
sounds like a hell of a lot of fun to produce. Maybe not as much fun to listen to.
It was. It was super goofy. So Jonathan doesn't drink, so he would kind of make sure that we would stay on track.
Yeah.
But I would start the podcast sober and we'd have little breaks in the podcast, which would take about an hour and a half total. And by the end of the podcast, I will have had 10 beers.
Oh, wow.
So it starts with me like being relatively normal Grant and ends with me doing a segment called Let the Drunk Fix It, where Jonathan would pose a problem from the sports world and my drunken brain would come up with a solution. Yeah. And it was a lot of fun, but we never could really break the threshold of like 300 listeners. Somehow it just didn't catch on. So
you know, a buddy of mine, Derek Tenbush, he wants to do that exact thing, but I believe with poker.
Ah, drunk poker. Huh,
yeah. That's interesting.
I think it's a lot easier to talk about sports than poker when you're drunk, but I think it depends on how deep you're going.
The two drunks have a great time together, but you know what I mean? But one sober person listening to drunks is maybe not quite as...
I guess. It depends on the drunk. I mean, I held it together pretty well.
I will say we only had like 300 people who listened, but they were a passionate 300 people. We still hear from them asking for the show to come back. Like, it was a really good show.
Maybe you didn't let it go long enough. How long did you guys do it?
Maybe a year.
We did it for a year and then we stopped and then we started up again with a sports betting angle instead without Grant drinking. And we did that for about 8 months and the same 300 people listened to that and liked it, but that was it. And we can just never grow it. And maybe you're right. Maybe if we just stuck with it, like,
well,
that's
which one interests you the most,
which sport, sorry.
Yeah. Which of the two shows interests you more? Or do you have an idea for another one that you think would work?
Oh, well, Drunk Sports was definitely the most interesting of them.
It was the most fun thing.
Yeah,
I've ever
done. There was another problem also, which was my wife was concerned that I was going to die.
Yeah.
Because it's probably not healthy to drink, I don't know, 10 or 11 beers once a week, every week.
We had this thing, though, which was drink along with Grant. And you could do the bronze medal, silver medal, and gold medal, right?
Yeah.
And bronze was like you're drinking, but you're drinking session ales, right?
Yeah.
And silver was you're doing whatever you're doing, and gold was you're doing twice as much. Is that right?
Yeah.
One guy who could do it was doing twice as much. So, I mean, it was incredible.
That sounds like an amazing show. You guys might want to do that one again.
I want to do it again.
But the thing is, like,
it was gold.
It just took up too much of our time. And
you're just like, shit-faced and worthless the next day.
Yeah. I also had a guaranteed hangover every week, which I don't love, you know? I mean, I want to pick and choose when I'm going to have a hangover, not just every Wednesday morning. Guarantee a hangover.
Steve, let's do it. You pass out, I shave your head. Internet history. There we go.
Make sure you get my eyebrows too.
There we go.
It's not, it's not good with you know, leaving me those things.
Maybe we need a visual element. Maybe we could try it again.
I mean, maybe. I want, you know,
I'm
you guys.
Inspired. I'm inspired.
You're making me want to do the show. I'm not kidding.
It sounds amazing. And especially since my buddy KB was talking about it, you know, just with poker. And I'm like, I don't know. That might be fun.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, I think there is something pretty well said earlier. I don't remember which one of you guys said it, but a lot of the time people aren't going to want to listen to a drunk guy talk. It's got to be the right drunk guy, or a guy who's not too drunk, you know.
He's not slurring and on his lips.
Yeah.
Well, what if you did it? Maybe a six pack is more sustainable. Is that
Steve? Swing your nuts out there and do it. Go full bore. Don't bother.
I think that's right.
Yeah, I agree.
You got to go for it.
No one wants to see someone drinking a six pack.
No,
maybe you guys just do it like one of those fantasy football podcasts where it's only football season. That way there's a light at the end of the tunnel and it's not eventually going to take, 43 years off your life.
Not a bad idea. But the problem is we like talking about basketball too.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
We really like it. Yeah. We like making lists, like who's the best shooting guard? Like that. It's fun.
I think it's guys who like their poker stuff will go over and check it out, Steve.
Yeah.
I mean, Steve, you have enough big of a follower. If we just had a video called, Steve swinging a stick in the park or something, there, a few hundred people would check it out. They wouldn't come back and watch it again, but no, I don't know. So coming down the line, the next couple of years, do you want to just write more books, do the things you're doing now, but just make them more successful? Or is there some other big project you want to maybe?
Yeah. What's your 2020 goal? Like what do you guys want?
We have a lot of projects in mind. So right now, Grant mentioned we do this show called Poker Time every week, which is the 5-10 cash game that we do commentary. We produce it as well. And right now it comes out, it's 1 hour a week. And so we only film it once a month and we film for 4 hours and it comes out. But we are talking about, we're actually going to go to a meeting after this show with you guys to see if we can actually set up something where we can turn that into a live stream, a much longer show. It'd be weekly. So it'd be like, 6-7 hours of poker live streamed with us doing commentary on YouTube, on Facebook, on Twitch. That's one potential project we're talking about. Another one is potentially doing a follow-up to the book. We're kicking that around. The book is all tournament hands, which we really love. And we had to not do a lot of cash game hands. That would have been really great. And so we think it wouldn't be such a bad idea to do a cash game book as well. So we're going to see how the book does before we commit to that. But we're looking at that also as a possibility.
My goal is to win the 2020 World Series of Poker main event. I think that's a good business goal.
Nice.
That would help us.
Yeah.
That's a smart goal. Yes.
Yeah. But yeah, mostly it has to do with upgrading Poker Time. There might be a few changes coming to the YouTube version of the breakdown.
Yeah.
We're going to tinker with the format. Not entirely sure how that's going to manifest yet, but that will be tinkered with. So improving Poker Time, and it's like 50-50. We're going to write another book.
Yeah. I think that's about right.
Yeah. Which, by the way, for those who want to check out the book, you can see a sample on Amazon or get the latest edition of Card Player, because we sent Card Player a sample and they liked it. And they're featuring one chapter in the book per issue for the next 5 issues.
Oh, nice. Okay.
Do you guys have a general website where all we can?
Yeah, I'm going to put a link in the show notes. So if you guys send me a link to whatever our listeners can click on that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really easy. We'll send you the link, but it's also thepokerguys.net. That's all about the book, and that'll send you to getting the ebook or getting the book on Amazon, the paperback version. As far as all of our other media, you can just type the Poker Guys into Google or a podcast aggregator, depending on what you want to see, and all of our stuff will come up.
Yeah, cool.
You ever have thinking about your own? Get my coaching in the business world, but something like, Live at the Bike, they not only do they have the stream, they have, it's like a training site, right? People will pay, I shouldn't say a training site, but people will pay money to watch the previous videos. Right.
And then they have a whole subscription model.
Yeah. Or in the Crush Live Poker thing where they have, you have the podcast and you have the videos. I don't know if that's something I'm guessing that those guys put a lot of effort into that. That's probably a major undertaking, but
yeah, it's a whole thing. We could do it down the road, but we're taking this one step at a time. We're going to try and get this big streaming thing going on. If we can pull that off, we're going to see how the world reacts to that. And we're hoping to grow Poker Time into a bigger thing than it is right now. And if we succeed at that, then maybe we can start to talk about subscription services or other things we can do to try and grow it. But right now I just hope we can get a stream game every week. That alone would be a big victory.
We just hope to have the technological prowess to do it.
Yeah.
Like that's step one.
This stuff is all really hard.
It's complicated, yeah. Man. Setting up the RFID table in the first place, getting it all right, it is a very complex process.
Took like months.
Yeah. You lost me at RIFD, whatever you just said.
How is your poker games, though? I mean, I wonder, as much as you're talking poker all the time, do you feel you're, when you're only playing, did you say once a week?
Yeah, once a week. What are you guys playing? 2-5, 5-10?
I am typically a tournament player. I'll play some cash games and like whatever the biggest stakes going on there is what I'm aiming for, which is in Portland, it never gets bigger than 5-10, except for maybe some underground games that I'm not invited to. but yeah, I play mostly tournaments and I personally don't play super frequently. Like I don't play once a week anymore. I kind of condense it all into small periods, poker trips, poker pilgrimages, you know, like last year spent a full month, 5 weeks at the World Series and played a tournament every day and playing stakes from $500 to the 10K main event. And, you know, a lot of 1500s in between, typically what I play. I feel like to the initial part of the question, from a theoretical perspective, I feel like I've gained a ton from doing this work with Jonathan and we learn together and we grow. At the same point, not playing every day, I lose a little bit of that poker muscle memory that just comes from playing live poker really, really frequently. And when I was playing it really frequently, I was maybe picking up a little bit better on some of the live stuff and the social stuff.
I play tournaments when I play. I also play some cash. And when I do, I'm either playing 20-40 or 30-60 limit hold'em or generally 5-5, no limit. When I'm playing that stuff, I don't know. I also was out there in the World Series for that same 5 weeks with Grant and playing every day, but I burn out faster than he does too. Like I get sick of it and need time away. So for me, it's like once a week is sometimes I can do twice a week
You do play, you're very motivated and happy to be there and playing well.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I'm really enjoying it when I'm there. And I believe that we talk poker, you know, multiple times a week. We go into depth of what we're watching the elite players play these hands. We have really in-depth conversations about it, sometimes trying to figure out what they're doing and why they're doing it, you know, and really seeking to understand. And that has absolutely helped my game in immeasurable ways. I agree there is something lost by not playing as often, but I think whatever I'm losing from that, I'm gaining on the other side from this, like, there's a level of strategy and understanding and depth to my game that just couldn't exist without the level of conversation we have all the time where we debate the tiniest points, you know? The little bit of minutia of like, how should you size this raise on the turn really helps, I think, when you get clear about why you'd want to do it one way versus the other.
Sure. That makes sense.
I feel the same way just from having this show and talking cards all the time and you know, getting books like yours and stuff like that. You're just studying a lot without realizing it.
You playing any online poker these days? You could grind an ACR or Bovada ever?
I was, but actually I stopped about 4 months ago and I have not gotten back on. I just like took a clean break from that also. And it's been really nice because what I was doing up until then is anytime I had any free time in my place, I just jump on and it would be sort of a lot of me procrastinating with it. And so I'm sort of doing more life things, which is great. So I haven't actually for about 4 months, but I was playing on Nitrogen, which is our sponsor, as well as I had played on ACR a long time ago, but really Ignition was the one I've been playing on.
Yeah. What's Nitrogen?
It's our sponsor. It's a Bitcoin only site that has poker and sports gambling and all sorts of other casino games. They're really good guys and really trustworthy and all that stuff.
They always pay out right away. It's great.
Yeah. but as for online poker for me, I think I was so into it pre-Black Friday, and it just feels like I can't get into it the way I once was until it's back for real, because I just have this nostalgic FOMO sort of that just like it kind of hurts a little bit to play online poker remembering what it once was.
Sure.
What's that site called? Nitrogen Poker?
Nitrogen Sports.
Well, so we can Nitrogen send you a link Sports. To that if you want to check it out.
Yeah. What are the tournament buy-ins?
Well, they vary, and it also depends on the price of Bitcoin on any given day, because it is a Bitcoin-only site.
They're all pretty small, though.
They're all pretty small. Really small. And, it's mostly small stakes stuff.
Like $1 to $10, or?
They probably get up to $50 on it.
I would guess. Yeah. I don't know. It's been a while since I played there, but yeah. I think they certainly $1 to $10 they have. Yeah.
Okay. A good place for the newer players to hone their skills.
Yeah, it is.
Absolutely.
And there's a fair amount of course, low stakes action as there is at all these sites.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool. Quickly, I just want to pick, since you guys have, you're obviously sports fans and football here coming up this week. We've got the Tennessee Titans versus the Kansas City Chiefs. Kansas City is favored by 7.5. How do you guys feel about that? Do you feel like that's a, would you go Tennessee plus 7.5 or Kansas City minus?
Put it all on Kansas City.
Yep, I'm with you. I'm completely with you. I think
has the line moved from 10? Was it once 10?
No, it wasn't. It was okay. 7. They both the line on both the games are somehow 7.5. I don't understand how the line for the Kansas City game is the same as the line for the San Francisco game.
Okay. Who do you like in this? Okay, it's Green Bay versus San Francisco. Yeah. San Francisco is also 7.5
right.
Favorite. Do you like Green Bay on that one?
Yeah. I think I like Green Bay and I like Kansas City for with, you know, Green Bay with the points, Kansas City giving the points. Kansas City can score so many points so fast. I think people are overrating Tennessee a little bit right now because of the damage that they did.
Recency bias.
Yeah. That said, yeah. I guess Kansas City also is a pretty showy win that they just had last weekend. So maybe that's not true.
You guys Seahawks fans or?
I am a Patriots fan. I grew up in New England. So everyone hates me out here.
Coast, yeah. I'm a Bears fan. I grew up in Chicago, so that's been rough for my entire life.
Yeah.
I was born in 1986. So
I was going to ask, yeah, how old you are. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm 33. I was born, I destroyed the Bears. I was born and yep. then never won again.
At least they've got, you know, a good young quarterback, Grant.
Shut the hell up.
Well, you thought he was a good young quarterback. Now you have to.
Yeah. For a second.
Yeah. For a minute.
Well. They're going to stay committed to him. Yeah. And I honestly don't understand how the Titans, who are the sixth seed, are the same level of dog as the Packers, who are a two seed. That just seems crazy to me.
And the Packers won, what, 13 games?
I think they won
14. 14-3.
I mean, winning in Baltimore is pretty, winning in Baltimore and New England is pretty amazing. Pretty good.
Yeah, that's true. So
they got a great running game, good defense, very tough team and coach and all that kind of stuff. But Kansas City's just, you know.
Yeah, but are they good by 8 points? That's the thing.
That's the question. I mean, it's a key number, right? I mean, seven, if it was seven, I think it's easy to take Kansas City. 7.5 is a really big difference.
It is. Big difference. Yeah, it's worth like 12 or 14 cents of value or something like that. I can't remember. Okay, let me ask you this. Okay, so you got to take, you take Kansas City 7.5, and then you take Green Bay plus 7.5. Which one do you feel more strongly about? Like which one, let's say you're going to, bet 600 on one and 400 on the other. Which one would you bet 600?
Steve
on?
Is actually holding a giant piggy bank over his head.
Right?
Pretty much.
He just wants to know where to.
Definitely do this. Put all the money on Kansas City. Kansas City is by far the best team that's left in this group. Tennessee is the worst team that's left. Kansas City's team is like made to score a million points. I would definitely, if I had to pick, I'd put as much money as I could on Kansas City versus the Green Bay game.
Okay. All right. I got to bet 6-4.
Okay,
well, on one of them in this tournament I'm in.
That's what I would do.
Okay, I was thinking the exact same thing actually. It just feels good to hear a little bit of confirmation there.
I mean, you know, it's sports betting. You walk around, people are going to give you bad opinions all the time.
Yeah, of course.
Expert opinion coming from Jonathan Lovie. It's a well-informed opinion, but it's mostly field player shit. Right?
That's right.
I'm in sixth place right now out of 172, I think.
Ooh,
that's so exciting. I'm excited. We got this week, and then we got the Super Bowl, which will be worth 10 points. And I'm
so. If you were to win the whole thing, what are we talking?
10,200. It was a 388 buy-in.
That's worth winning.
That's your main event.
It's worth winning, yeah. It's, considering it really only takes about 45 minutes a week to do this. I just follow a math formula and then it's done.
You know, you might, not to get all into strategy with this, but you might want to start to think about what the five people in front of you are going to do. And if they're all going to pick things a particular way, you might want to go the opposite way to try and win, even if you don't like the picks as much.
The nuclear option?
Yeah.
I've thought of that and I don't know how they're going to bet. I've been looking at him for the last few weeks and I haven't put together a pattern of like, how's he making his pick here? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Cause sometimes the line will move, but you're still betting on this number here and they don't adjust for that.
Well, that's amazing.
Right. That's the edge right there. Yeah. But, so I was talking with my brother about it, who's currently in first, And I was like, I think I'm just going to go on the math because I can't tell what the hell these guys are going to pick. And you can't see what they pick until after the game starts.
Right. So, sure. That's fair.
Yeah. Okay. Sports. Well, do you have any other questions, Mikey? Or should we move on to the strategy?
Strategy.
Yeah.
Okay. That's all fine. Right. Strategy.
Right on. I've got a couple of hands, or if you guys have one you wanted to talk about.
Go ahead.
Go ahead, Stevie.
Okay. I was playing at a table. This was a $400 win tournament, one of those daily ones, just before Christmas time. This last year, like a month ago. And I sat down and I instantly recognized one guy that I've had on the show before. I'm like, oh, hey, Pete. And then a couple of the other guys looked familiar. And then after a few minutes, I realized, and Pete affirmed it, we're probably the worst table in the whole tournament because it was just him was a pro. And then there was just a line of rocks and regulars that live in Vegas and just play these things like every day. Right. So anyways, that's the table that we're at. This is the second level. No, it's got to be the third level because the levels are 100, 200, 200. We got the ante. We have about a starting stack, which was 15K. And Villain will also have about the same starting stack of 15K. And we got King, Queen of Diamonds under the gun. It's seven-handed.
We're opening, obviously.
Okay.
I mean, yes, we're definitely going to play this hand.
Yeah, I imagine. Let's raise. I imagine we're making it 500 or 600, yeah, depending on what your proclivities are.
Okay. Mikey, same thing?
Yep.
Okay. I'd been opening bigger, and they didn't really catch on to it until after, like, a few hours. And then they started to see, like, Steve keeps opening, like, 3.6x, and he's just taking down, stealing the blinds, like, every time. And anytime anyone calls, they're almost always out of position, and he's going to c-bet. And so, anyways, I did the same thing on this one. I did 675. It folds all the way around to the big blind. He calls, and he's a kind of a new professional poker player. I think he said he'd been playing full time now for like a year or two, and playing well. Seemed tight. I think I'd put his range like all pairs, broadways.
And first of all, what I'd be curious what these guys think about your opening raise size.
I think if you have a holistic strategy that is opening to that size because you feel the table responds in a way that is more advantageous to you due to that sizing, if you think you're stealing the pots with 50% more frequency than if you made it 500, I think it's probably worth it. Depends on how adjustable your opponents are. And also, if you are opening the same every time, it's an unopened pot. If you're opening to different sizes with different hand strengths, obviously that's a problem.
Yeah.
I agree with everything Grant said. It's certainly more than I normally make it in almost every situation. But if you feel like you have a really good reason, it sounds like you did. That's reasonable to me.
Just saying that, Steve, when you're talking about ranging his big blind defend range should be lower than it is.
Yeah, sure.
It should be a little tighter. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think so, right? It narrows him. As the other guys were making it like min raise. They go 400 or they go 500, and they're getting four callers, and then they're just like frustrated that, you know, and when you make it that big, I almost always get heads up.
Yeah, I will say though, like usually when you're at the first few levels, it's going to be less effective to get less callers. You know, as you get a little later in the tournament, you are. But my experience anyway is that people like level one, they're going to have like 150 blinds. And even at this level, they have 75 blinds. People are going to be pretty willing to call, you know, 3.5x also. But although I'm never doing it, so maybe I'm wrong. Actually.
Yeah, I don't know. But I'm imagining myself as the big blind, and I think my range probably would not adjust as much as you might think.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
When you're this deep.
When you're this deep, sure. Yeah.
When you're this deep.
Like, okay. I don't know if I think I'm still calling hands like queen eight suited and stuff like that. You know, I think.
I'd be calling there with queen eight suited. Yeah. Okay. All right. So we raise it. We get heads up. We got 1650 in the pot with a little less than 15K behind. And the flop is, we got king, queen of diamonds. And the flop is ace of diamonds, 6-3. I didn't write down the suits of the 6-3, but it wasn't, it wasn't two-tone. Yeah, it must have been rainbow.
They were unlikely to be diamonds, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Villain pretty quickly checks, with maybe like 2 seconds.
I think this is a bet.
I feel like this is a clear down bet. Yep. It's a dry board. You have a clear range advantage. You have way more big aces in your range. You have sets of aces in your range. Villain might have more of the random two pairs, like the ace six and ace three off, but still, that's not enough to make it so that you have any sort of disadvantage. You have a clear range advantage. So with the dryness of the board, I think I like making it something like 550. Something like that.
You also have two back doors, so you're gonna have a lot of nice barreling opportunities on the turn where you're gonna pick up equity, which is pretty sweet if called.
Okay, those sound like very good reasons. I don't know why, but I checked. I'm trying to think if I figured I could do like a delayed C bet on the turn. If a diamond came in, I thought I might have the best hand here a lot, which would be a reason for a bet. I don't know, but I think you're right. I think that is a bet there.
Yeah, the board is really just better for you than it is for your opponent.
And you have nominal showdown value, but it's not a comfortable showdown value. We're necessarily going to call two barrels, especially at the stage of the tournament. So it's not like you want to turn your hand into a bluff catcher. So yeah, I think it's probably better to just try to take a shot here for 550 or even 500 due to the dryness of the board and your range advantage. And it's the type of board, clearly with the ace of diamonds, where you have a lot of double and even triple barrels when certain cards come. Any diamond comes, any Broadway card comes. That kind of gives you license to go a little bit nuts.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Okay. Well, I check behind.
Okay.
So we go to the turn. We got 1650 in the pot. We have king, queen of diamonds. And with the flop, the ace of diamonds, 6-3. The turn is the eight of diamonds.
Ooh, nice.
Okay.
I like it. So that's a bet, right? Oh, wait, actually, does our opponent check?
Villain checks.
All right. Well, that's even better. We're just going to win a lot here.
Yeah, I think it's still a down bet because the villain has shown no aggression. And it's a board where basically if you bet big, you're saying, I have a set of eights now. It's kind of a weird thing if you bet like 1100 into 1650 now, having checked the flop. It's kind of saying I have a set of eights or ace king or ace queen that I checked back, which I guess is possible, but most good players aren't going to expect that from another player that they respect.
Yeah.
What if this guy donked into you? Would you consider raising there, or are you just going to be happy with the equity you picked up?
I'm mostly going to just be calling because I'm in position and we're deep.
Depends on the size, I guess. It
certainly depends on the size. I agree with that. But I think my instinct is usually to call there in position because I can always try and take it away on the river anyway.
Yeah. And
I get a lot more information.
If you're raising, you're not really telling a good story. You're just hoping that they're lying.
Right.
You're just saying like, you don't have it, so I'm going to raise you. It's not like I'm doing a good job telling you that I have ace king here.
I mean, what we're saying is I check back top set on the flop when we raise, right?
Right.
And it just seems like, I mean, okay, but it's hard to do. It's hard to have that. And I guess once in a while, but mostly we're going to be betting. So it doesn't mean to say we should never raise. And I think sometimes our opponent may size it in a way like small enough that we feel more comfortable raising, right? Where it feels like they don't really like their hand and they don't really know where they are in the spot, and they're just sort of betting to because they're trying to almost block a bigger bet, and we can just make their lives tough right now, and that's okay too. Surely to raise there.
Let's say you actually knew what the guy's hand was, and he was just pot controlling like a crummy ace here, like ace seven off. Would you still be trying to bet turn and bomb river maybe on? I'd be curious if Steve bets turn and he gets called, like which rivers we're planning on betting. Are there any give ups? That sort of thing, I guess. It's like, because usually if we get called here, a lot of time it is going to be a bad ace.
We're talking about the scenario where the opponent has checked and we're betting, right? Not no longer.
Right. No. Betting. Yeah. He checks. Yeah. We bet, they call.
I mean, he can have a lot of things besides just an ace, but you're saying if we know he has an ace, so that's different, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So well, if he has a bad ace, this is something I come up with cash games a lot where it's, I see bet, do the down bet, like you said, usually with the ace. I get called, sometimes it's second pair, so, but I'm always in the, well, I'm going to bet again if I pick up any equity kind mm-hmm. of thing. So with king, with the king, queen suited, like any, let's say he see bet, there's so many, like almost half the deck gives him more equity on the turn, like any paint. Gives him a straight draw.
Yeah.
Of all the diamond draws. Maybe that's getting, well, you guys do 45 minute hand analysis. So I think it's not,
oh yeah.
It's not, normal it's not for bad us. To go backwards to no. think of these things. But yeah, I mean, for me, it's like just kind of putting my finger in the wind. Sometimes I'm like, okay, I know this person has a crummy ace. Do I want to go three streets with it kind of thing?
I mean, part of it is the story that we're telling. So because we checked the flop, it's a much harder story to sell this guy to fold his crummy ace. I think
right.
If we bet the flop and we bet the flop and we picked up diamonds on the turn, so I feel very comfortable betting the turn. I might, I get a call. I'd probably be thinking, even before the guy called, I'm probably triple barreling this because
the river's probably going to be something.
The river, yeah.
The river's probably going to be something like a pot-sized bet. Also,
yeah, it's going to be big.
Yeah.
It's going to be big. And the only time I'm not triple barreling maybe is if I hit a king or a queen, where sometimes I'm beating some of my opponent's calling range. But mostly I'm just going to triple barrel and it's going to be really hard to call down with a weak ace, especially against this player profile that we've heard about.
On the turn, which better hands could he be folding and which worse hands could he be calling with, I guess? Is that... Is that not quite as... specifically relevant here because we also don't mind putting a few chips in case we hit our hand.
That's certainly part of it. And you're talking about when we have king, queen of diamonds, right?
I'm talking specifically on this when you said you would still bet the turn and down bet it. Now, I'm thinking because like you said, we're less likely to have an ace. I don't think he's folding any pair here. I could be
wrong. No, I don't think so either.
Like right. He's probably... not calling with worse unless he specifically has a worse diamond draw.
Correct.
Or a couple small cards. Maybe he's, yeah, I don't know.
And he might be betting his diamond draws and his straight draws anyway, rather than check calling them.
So I agree with all of that, but I think that's a more relevant thought process on the river than it is on the turn because a major part of this bet, especially since we're down betting here, is equity denial. We are very happy for him to fold Jack 10 offsuit here, you know, hands like that. It's just, you know, he showed no aggression. We might as well take the chips in the pot without allowing him a free shot at building equity in a spot where if we check back and he hits a pair of any type, it's going to be really hard to tell a story that can get him to fold on the river.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The other thing, too, is there are a lot of hands that can call turn that are better than ours that absolutely are going to fold river, right? Like we just said, we think he's going to call with any pair, but he's not going to call a river big bet with that same any pair range, right? It's going to be a much smaller range. It might be aces. But now we've actually created a situation where if we're getting called by any pair that aces make up a minority of that range, probably not a majority,
yeah,
especially when he checks the turn.
If he has 8-9 offsuit or something like that, so he's just
right.
Turn second pair, it's going to be tough for him to call a down bet here and then subsequently like a pot-sized river bet.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that makes sense. If you were to bet here and get called, are you pretty much potting every river card that maybe doesn't pair the board? I mean, what are you thinking about in terms of the rest of the deck? What you would be thinking about if you got called here?
The only card I might not bet, I'm thinking is like maybe an eight specifically. Another eight seems like kind of a bad card.
Yeah, an eight. I mean, almost any board pair is pretty bad, as you mentioned.
Yeah.
Also a king or a queen, I think I'm probably not betting.
Right.
Just going to hope that I win.
Really? You're
yeah.
not going to do like a small little value bet with a king? Is that just where we're value owning ourselves? Oh, and only ever calls
concerned. I'm concerned about it being fancy play syndrome to try to value bet a king or a queen.
Right. We already said he's going to fold it.
He's probably going to fold an eight if there's a.
Right. So what do you
mean? And if we're only doing a small bet if we hit a king or a queen, and otherwise we're sizing it up over time, if we're playing this opponent with any frequency and he knows anything, he's going to pick up on that and pounce on that type of sizing in the future.
And this whole table is apparently relatively good and probably paying attention too. So I think we got it.
Yeah, they are.
So what did you do on the turn, Stevie? Did you bet?
I did.
Okay.
Right.
So we had 1650 in the pot, turning the flush draw with the king, queen of diamonds. I bet 900 into 1650. What's your guys' thought on the sizing?
Yeah, that's too big.
Yeah.
What would you get if
You're saying a down bet of like 600 or something? Or
yeah, I think same philosophy as the flop. The majority, like to Mike's point about what's going to call us, the majority of this bet is equity denial, and we're going to achieve equity denial against hands like Jack 10 with a 600 chip bet, the same that we are with a 900 with a chip bet.
Yeah.
So it also makes it easier to do a pot size bet on the river if we bet 600 now, and it kind of changes the math for him on the river if that pot size bet is actually a pot size bet versus if it's the same size bet that's not a pot size bet because we bet 900 now, so it's a slightly smaller bet. Typically, I just like a smaller bet.
The other thing, too, is I think you're getting a binary response, meaning like the hands that are going to fold, they're going to fold. The hands that are going to call are going to call if you bet 600 or 900. So why not bet 600 since we want them to fold anyway? Like the pairs are going to call. It's cheaper than when the pairs call. And then thus our bluff is smaller on the
if for some reason he's disciplined enough to check the a set or a monster hand twice, of course, if you also check raises here, if we made it smaller, we
save.
We might be able to call.
We can call to hit our flush. Yeah. Where we make it 900 and he makes it 4,500 here, we're kind of not getting the right price.
Yeah.
Yeah, and no, that's a really good point.
The implied odds are not as good either.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, this is a big one too, because this is a blind and a half right here just on this one street. Mm. So that, okay. All right. I bet 900. Villain calls.
Okay. It mostly has one pair.
Yeah.
Okay. So the board is ace of diamonds, 6-3, eight of diamonds. We have king, queen of diamonds in position, and the river is a deuce. It's rainbow, not a diamond. So we didn't hit our flush. Villain takes about 5-6 seconds and then counts out 3,700. There's 3,450 in the pot.
Wow, that's weird.
Any leads? I assume he didn't just count it, but he put it in the pot.
Yeah, when he places it in the pot, yes. Yeah, he led.
So unless he's playing a flush or straight draw, and mostly a flush draw this way.
4-5 did get there, yeah.
Yeah, so I guess he could be playing a flush draw this way, and but this does not seem like this is like an amateur way to play a flush draw, and this guy is not an amateur. So I tend to think I want to fold.
If this guy's like a regular player, I think typically a typical way to play these $400 type tournaments, if you're one of the better players in the field, is to simply go for value early on in the tournament.
Yeah.
So I feel like if this guy is a solid player, it's a lot more likely that he's not just going to try to mess around. When you've taken a line that is, I guess, slightly weak based on the check on the flop, but I mean, it's also the stage in the tournament where a lot of players are going to feel obligated to call with a hand like ace-jack if they checked it back on the flop. So it's not an ideal time for him to be bluffing. I fear that he has quite a strong hand.
Yeah.
Maybe he's made two pair or a straight on the river.
It seems like he wants you to have ace-10 or kings or queens and make a hero call here. And he just doesn't have any reason at all to put this many chips in as a bluff, I don't think.
Right. Like, unless we know a lot about the guy and we know he takes lines like this as bluffs with heavy frequency, which I haven't heard any indication of that yet.
If he wanted to make a play at you, he could have done it on the turn. He could have just check raised the turn or bet the turn. Those, you know, could have had a very, those could have been powerful too. Like a check raise on the turn is pretty powerful.
He doesn't necessarily three bet nines, tens, jacks pre.
Mm-hmm, true.
Is there any chance we can get him off? We put him on a one pair hand somewhere in that range. I mean, I don't know how we play that there. He would definitely call the turn when we don't see bet. Would he now try to, I don't know, this might be going to like ninth level shit, but kind of a mergey bet to get us to fold queens if he has nines, but maybe we'll also hero with something worse. I don't know.
I think that's like a something you see on TV and like something that Joe Stapleton will highlight when it happens, but it's a very rare thing to be happening.
Right.
You know? Yeah.
Also with this sizing, like, he's sort of like, he's supposed to be blocking with nines and tens, you know, like it's weird to turn those into a bluff and to turn them into a bluff this way. You know, it seems real. I don't know what he has, but it seems really unlikely to me that he's got nines and tens and is choosing the sizing here and suddenly the donk out of flow.
So it sounds like both of you guys are on team fold here.
I'm on team fold.
Yes, I am. Yeah.
What happened?
What do you think, Mikey?
I mean, I'm always.
Are you thinking shove or like what?
I'm always I feel like in a live cash game, I'm going to sense where he is a little better. So I don't, it's hard to say. I mean, yeah, tournament, early stages of the tournament, I think a lot of people are just playing for value. I think that as a default, if this was like late, you know, somehow you're on the bubble of a tournament or something like that, you know, you can obviously get them to fold
some
quality value hands. But here, I think you just got to fold.
Let it go. Okay. I took a little while and I kind of got him at least able to kind of react a little bit, you know what I mean? Kind of move in his seat. And he just felt like he didn't want me to call. But then another part of me was like, well, like a pair of threes right here is a bluff and I can't even beat that.
Yeah.
I think in the long run, this was a mistake, but I flick in a call and he had Jack Nine offsuit.
Wow. What? Jack Nine?
Yeah.
That wasn't even a straight draw on the turn, was it?
Was it 7-8 on the turn? So he had the gutter?
No, it's 8-6-3-8 deuce.
He just decided the line. He decided Steve never had an ace, which he didn't, and he was just going to call and probably donk wow. every single river. Probably
shocking. Wow. Shocking that he didn't check raise the turn.
Well, when I showed my hand, he's like, "That's exactly what I thought you had, and I never thought you'd call that." So, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, his line would have worked against me.
For sure.
To his credit.
But if he thinks that's what you have, he could also just check raise big on the turn. I mean,
yeah, and
deny you some equity as well. I mean, although maybe he's worried you're just going to shove or not get away from it. I don't know.
It sounds like this guy's got serious fancy play syndrome.
Yeah, you described him as this tight, careful player.
Yeah, I guess maybe that was a little up to that point. That's kind of how he was.
Yeah, that happens though.
You're bluffing us all, Steve.
I guess so. Maybe I don't know if this was just the. What's even the opposite of a bad beat story where you just want to pat on the back or something? But I kind of ran through a little bit of stuff on Slice and I'm like, oh, there's a lot of hands that fucking beat me here. Am I really getting a price to be able to call that? So it doesn't sound like he used it to me, used it against me later because he did the same kind of thing, moving all in blind on blind. I basically had bottom pair and I got him talking, and to his credit, he put his chips in the same way. The way he was acting, the facial expressions, everything was exactly like when he was bluffing. And so I call like a goddamn robot. That time he had top pair. I'm like, okay, never mind.
Yeah, I would have folded, but yeah, like I did disagree with the analysis that where they really were leaning towards this guy having a really strong hand. Like, I don't know, but just like a deuce doesn't improve anything other than 5-4.
Yeah.
And I think, if he somehow flopped his set, I think, he's either check raising turn or leading turn, isn't he?
You'd expect a lot of the time if he flopped a set. I would think that the majority of his range is strong hands that got strong on the river, such as ace deuce, or he probably, I don't know, 5-4 off is a maybe call in that spot pre-flop. I know you sized it up, but some players are going to call.
Could he have 5-4 diamonds? I mean, that makes sense.
He could have, definitely.
That's only one combo, diamonds, though.
But, and maybe other 5-4 suiteds that.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you block, like you said, you block nothing. Like he could have been throwing fives out there just to get you to fold tens or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, so totally.
It's a fold.
Jack nine off suit. What a ridiculous play.
It's pretty ridiculous.
Yeah. That almost worked.
Well, I assume no one tried to bluff you for a very long time after that hand, though, right? At the table?
No, I had quite the reputation after that. Yeah.
That's useful. I mean, that's powerful.
I suppose it was, yeah. I did have another interesting one. This just quickly. I pick up queens in like UTG plus one. I raise the guy that I told you that I recognized at the table that's been on the show, Pete. Pete Morris, he three bets me. And then the big blind amateur, one of the only soft spots at the table, looks at his hand, puts it down, kind of lets out a sigh, then shoves all in.
Well, that's an easy play.
Yeah, you just got
so I fold. Pete did not look worried at all. He calls, and it was aces and kings. Mm. But that was...
It's nice when the amateurs really just tell you what they have with
their acting. God, it was amazing. I'm like, this is one of the easiest folds of my life.
I love the sigh. I love the sigh and the shrug.
Yeah. Yes, the sigh and the shrug. And like, well, I guess I got to do this.
Yep.
It was a fun game, though. It was a fun game. I lasted, I think, 5 or 6 hours or something. But
That's good for
you, Steve. It was the toughest table that I played at in probably a year. But it was cool.
So you guys, is it too early to talk about Vegas? Have they put the schedule out yet?
They just released the schedule of 1K and lower buy-in events. I saw today. And then I think they've released the schedule of championship events, meaning all the 10K events. And I don't think they've released stuff like Millionaire Maker, Monster Stack, and Marathon, stuff like that yet. I'm not really sure.
I mean, do you guys, when you said you go every summer, do you go rent a house and you're there the whole time? Or are you going to fire in for, you know, pick out four tournaments you like and fire in there for 10 days? Or
the last 2 years, both years, 2018 and 2019, we've gone for the entire summer.
Okay.
And rented a house, and renting a house is the only way to do it if you're going to spend the entire summer renting a house, renting a car.
Yeah.
Ultimately, for everybody involved, because it was us and a couple other people, it was a little bit too much, I think. It's just being in Vegas for that long, just grinding out poker tournaments is tough to do for 5 weeks. So this year, I think both of our plans is to go for less time, something like a 2 week period, and then perhaps for the main event separately. Something like that.
Okay. My plan is to definitely play like the Monster Stack, the Millionaire Maker, stuff like that.
Sure.
And we'll see what happens basically beyond that. Like, yeah, it's 10 days to 2 weeks sounds good.
Did
to
you
me.
Play the main event last year? Or
granted, I didn't.
Yeah, I did. Did the old kings into aces when I had about 50 blinds effective thing. Got in on the flop.
Yeah.
You know, busting the main event really hurts. Really don't like it. It's not fun.
Stinger.
Yeah.
It let's see, 2 weeks. Yeah, I'm probably going to do about the same. And the house is definitely the way to go.
Yeah,
then you can absolutely cook your own food, and doing that in a hotel is just not
right. You have to have a way to separate yourself from all the madness that is the Las Vegas Strip and all of the things that are going on with all the poker tournaments. To have like a place to call home, your own bedroom, a kitchen, stuff like that. Very important if you're going to be there for any more than 4 or 5 days, I think.
Yeah, normalcy.
Yeah, I agree. Cool.
Okay, Stevie.
Else, Mikey?
No, I need to go to work here, homie.
Okay, right on. Good deal. And you guys have a hard out. Yeah, let's go ahead and wrap it up. You can. What's your guys' Twitter handle?
We are at 2PokerGuys, the number 2PokerGuys. That's where you can find links to our book, which, of course, is at thepokerguys.net, and to all of the other content and media we produce, which you can also find just by Googling us.
Right on. Good deal. We'll put links in the show notes and you can check that out. And thank you for tuning in. Here is your weekly motivational speech.
Today is the beginning of the rest of your life, and it can be very frightening. It's a new world out there. It's a mean world out there. And you only live once. So do what you feel passionate about. Take chances. Don't be afraid to fail. There's an old IQ test was 9 dots, and you had to draw 5 lines with a pencil within these 9 dots without lifting the pencil. The only way to do it was to go outside the box. So don't be afraid to go outside the box. Don't be afraid to think outside the box. Don't be afraid to fail big. To dream big. But remember, dreams without goals are just dreams. And they ultimately fuel disappointment. So have dreams, but have goals. Life goals, yearly goals, monthly goals, daily goals. I try to give myself a goal every day. And understand that to achieve these goals, you must apply discipline and consistency. In order to achieve your goals, you must apply discipline, which you have already done, and consistency every day, not just on Tuesday and miss a few days. You have to work at it every day. You have to plan every day. You've heard the saying, we don't plan to fail, we fail to plan. Hard work works.
Working really hard is what successful people do.